Welcome to the Undiplomatic Podcast. Today we have our guest host, Emma Ashford, joining us. And we also have some of the regular crew, Hunter Marsden.
Hello.
So Emma, do you want to give us a bit about yourself today?
Yeah, great. So thanks so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, but I'm really glad I don't have to actually imitate Van, because that would be quite difficult. So for those who don't know, I'm a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I work in a program called the New American Engagement Initiative, which is a little unorthodox. We're basically a sort of a red cell for US foreign policy, questioning the assumptions of US foreign policy and trying to rethink how we might make it better. Before that, I was at the Cato Institute doing foreign policy, which is also kind of a place for fairly heterodox thinkers. So that's the approach with which I tend to deal with a lot of foreign policy questions. I am a specialist in Russia and also in the politics of the Middle East, because my background is in studying energy. But I also spend quite a lot of time talking about US foreign policy more generally. Things have been heating up in Europe, and not in a really good way. Basically, anybody that's been watching this closely through open source methods, the intelligence community, Russia is moving a whole bunch of military material right up close to the Ukrainian border. This looks like it's potentially going to be an invasion of Ukraine. People are very worried about this. And so there's been a lot of debate about how the Biden administration should respond to that. Ukraine obviously has been in this limbo state for a number of years, where it was kind of offered NATO membership by the Bush administration, but other European states weren't all that keen on it. And then eventually, after the Ukraine tried to join the European Union in 2014, there was a revolution. Russia invaded part of the country, seized Crimea. And so it sort of looks like the stalemate that has been in place for the last, about 6 years is ending, and we might be moving towards either a diplomatic or a military resolution of this crisis. So I think this is setting up to be one of the biggest stories for the start of 2022.
Biden and Putin had a phone call to presumably de-escalate tensions. How do you think that went?
I think it actually seems to have gone relatively well. The Biden administration seems to be adopting a fairly balanced approach to this issue, which is, that they're talking a lot about reassuring NATO allies, but they're also being pretty clear that the US isn't actually going to go and fight in Ukraine. And Biden, in the call with Putin, effectively agreed that we could talk to Russia about some of these bigger European security issues, the question of what happens to states like Ukraine or Georgia, that Russia doesn't want them to join NATO, but they don't want to move towards Russia. And so there's this overarching question of European security. And I think the Biden administration seems to actually be open to talking about that, which is one of the very few ways we might de-escalate this crisis.
And one thing that strikes me as different here in the crisis in 2021, at the end of 2021, but you sent around an article from Maxim Saramikov at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which was really interesting to me because it states or sort of looks at how Putin has laid out some demands, which seems like a novel or a shift in tactics here. If the Kremlin is laying out demands and being very clear about what it wants from the West and from NATO with regard to Ukraine and its own interests there, does that stem from a position of confidence or perhaps even weakness and insecurity?
I think it's an indication that Russia here is preparing perhaps to go big because they think the situation is so bad that they have to, that a window is closing to sort of retain Ukraine in the Russian sort of area of interest before it slips away to the West. If you talk to people in Moscow, you read what's coming out of some of sort of the Russian foreign policy elite, what you hear over and over is that they feel that this window is closing. They feel that there is a risk that, even if Ukraine doesn't get formal NATO membership, that there's going to be NATO troops on Ukrainian soil, there's going to be infrastructure and military equipment, and that they are really quite concerned about this. And so we, in the West, we don't see these things as necessarily all that threatening. The Russians actually seem to. And so, you don't have to agree with what they're doing. You don't have to think it's a good idea. But I think you can definitely see where Russia is coming from on this. And as you say, one of the interesting things is that Putin has actually made some concrete asks, you know, and they're big asks that the US and that NATO and other European states would enter into this basically renegotiation of the post-Cold War European security architecture. That's a huge ask. I'm not sure that we're going to get that. I'm not sure if we're even going to be able to talk about those big issues. But the fact that they are putting that on the table and saying, you know, it's this or it might be war, you know, I think is a step forward from some of the sort of just fiddling around the edges that we've seen over the last decade.
Being outside of Washington, I'm curious to get your perspective there. Is there a risk Biden, is he being attacked by some of the traditional defense hawks on the Hill for appearing weak here? I mean, does he feel boxed in and like he has to keep a tough line? In many ways, the U.S. has already sort of made some concessions by allowing the status quo to be preserved, given that Ukraine-NATO talks have been ongoing for some years, right?
Biden's under a fair amount of pressure from hawks here, as he has been through his whole term. Even before the current crisis, before the current tensions, Biden was under a lot of pressure from congressional Republicans on the question of Nord Stream 2, which is, you know, we don't want to get into too many details, but basically an energy pipeline. The Germans want it, the Russians want it. It would be bad for the Ukrainians. And so, you know, congressional hawks have been trying to stop that through sanctions. And so Biden has been under pressure here. But I think, again, we saw this with Afghanistan and we're seeing it again now. The administration seems to be willing to sort of stick to their guns on issues they think are important. And I think in this case, you know, at least what we're seeing right now is that they're not going in all gung-ho. You know, the fact they're willing to say the US isn't going to send troops to fight in Ukraine, that is, you know, I think that's a sign that they're not going to give in to some of the sort of congressional hawks on this.
Our second quick hit for today is the Democracy Summit.
Oh, where to start? We could take all night on this. So, I mean, long story short, I think the Democracy Summit is a self-inflicted wound that the Biden administration simply didn't have to walk into. They didn't have to do this at all. And I'm sure it was really tempting to have this sort of foreign policy promise that looks good, that they're following through on. But the whole thing has just been a bit of a mess. And to be honest, it's actually to their credit. And I think that it hasn't been worse than it is. But, you know, the questions over who would get invited, you know, would we invite states that were important but were democratically backsliding? Would we invite states like Hungary that are treaty allies but have democratic problems? Would we invite, you know, would this be states that might be helpful in pushing back on China or Russia but they're not democracies? And so, you know, the guest list is what you would expect. It's the usual suspects from Western Europe, North America, few from elsewhere in the world, and then some kind of edge states. Right. And then there are a few like the Democratic Republic of the Congo is invited, where you're just sort of genuinely scratching your head and wondering what the heck's going on. And so, you know, I am skeptical that much good is going to come out of this Democracy Summit. I think to the extent that it's useful, it might be useful in sort of talking about common threats that democracies face, right? Disinformation, you know, populism, you know, cross-national populism. But again, I'm not sure a summit's the right way to handle that. So I'm pretty skeptical that we're going to see much out of this other than a few photo ops.
Yeah. Speaking of populism, you know, the inclusion of Brazil and India, Narendra Modi and Bolsonaro and Modi, respectively, being both authoritarian populists, does not bode well for substantial statements or progress coming out of this summit. But from a broader perspective, I totally agree with you and the points you raised. I'm also persuaded by the arguments I've heard others make that this should have gone for a shorter list and more substantive discussion rather than a wide list with a thin sort of superficial proceeding from it.
That's probably a good point. I mean, because again, the things that you would want to actually achieve from this are substantive, right? So you want to get together countries that are going to work on kleptocracy, anti-kleptocracy legislation, right? Or you want to get to other countries that can work on technological issues. And again, that's going to be a smaller set of countries, but you might actually achieve something with it. I think more broadly, this summit is a reflection of where the administration is in thinking about foreign policy more generally, and they are trying to frame it in this democracy versus autocracy frame, simultaneously not excluding, working with autocracies when we need to against China or Russia. And I think that's a little confused, to be honest. It's not clear to me that democracy is as salient as, anti-communism was during the Cold War. It's not clear to me that democracy is a good way to rally states. And so again, I'm just very skeptical of this whole enterprise, and not really sure why we're focusing on it, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, great point. And you raised the broader competition with China and Russia, which raises the question, is the democracy summit for the sake of democracy itself, or is it more about geopolitical competition, strategic competition with China and Russia? And if the goal is to counter China's influence, the failure to include key frontline states in Southeast Asia, for instance, such as Singapore, nominally a democracy, and barring allies like Thailand, presents a really awkward point for the administration, which has included some Southeast Asian states, but not others. And in Southeast Asia, for instance, the distinction between democracy and authoritarianism is a fuzzy one to begin with, and not a particularly attractive one for rallying countries to support U.S. objectives in the broader competition with China.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the arguments that I keep hearing pop up here in D.C. is that, that not inviting countries might provide them with incentives to improve democratically, and that the summits themselves, and there's some hope that they'll be annual, I believe, will provide a carrot for countries like Thailand that clearly are on that line straddling democracy and autocracy right now, will provide some incentive for them to do so. Again, I'm not really sure how that works. I'm not really sure how, you think that this summit is enough of an incentive. Maybe if they come up with something more concrete at this summit than in future years, perhaps. But, for now, it's sort of an empty promise.
All right, so it's for Prediction Market this week. It's not Prediction Market anymore. We haven't come up with a new name for it. Well, I haven't come up with a new name for it because I'm a bit lazy. But essentially what it is I've got three headlines, one of which is true. Others might be a little bit true, but ultimately were never headlines. And your job, my friend Emma, is to decide what one is true. Headline one, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega found guilty of running a troll farm as part of a disinformation campaign to aid re-election this year. Headline two, India signs agreement with Russia to produce over 600,000 Kalashnikov rifles. Strange. And headline three, Donald Trump finally concedes the 2020 presidential election. So what one out of those three do you believe to be true?
Okay, so the problem is there's one that's obviously not true, but actually I know it is because Donald Trump doesn't understand double negatives. And I believe he accidentally issued a statement saying that he didn't not win the 2020 election or whatever it was. So that one's true.
It's partly true. He never openly conceded it. He's just an idiot. So unfortunately, that one's not quite true.
Well, so the other two, again, I could see both of them being true. I don't actually know. I do know that Putin was in India in the last week. There were some great photo ops with Modi, and there is growing sort of Russian-Indian defense industry cooperation. So the Kalashnikovs might be true. But equally, Ortega has a reputation for trying to steal elections. So I have to admit, I'm stumped here. I'm going to say the Kalashnikovs are true and the Ortega one is fake, but I might be wrong.
Well done. Yep, correct. Correct.
Yes.
That's two for two. Ben got his right last week too, and you got yours right this time. Yep, Russia is part of one of the many agreements between Modi and Putin, Russia and India. One of them, interestingly, is to produce over 600,000 Kalashnikov rifles, as if Russia probably couldn't do it themselves already. So that's, I just never thought I'd see India producing Kalashnikov rifles for Russia. I just thought that looked fake. And then I had to do my research. It turned out it was scarily true. Well,
the Russians are, they are actually working the Indians. They're trying to build ties there, and everybody, all the attention goes to the purchase of the S-400s. But, you know, the Russians really want to sell arms. It's one of their sources of hard cash. And so, they've got these ties with India. They've got these ties all across sort of Southeast and South Asia.
Well, listeners, I have a favor to ask. If you can email in or Twitter in or however you want to contact us, and give me ideas for a new name for this segment, because I'm absolutely blank and I'd love to hear your suggestions. Well, that's us. Prediction market for what's left of it.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So from Gabby, who can't be here today, we've got two tweets this week. So the first is from Richard Haas, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And his tweet says, "The emergence of what could be a dangerous new COVID variant in Africa underscores the myopia that has informed the developed world's vaccine nationalism from the start. It would have been right and smart to vaccinate the world. The US and others failed on both counts." So do you have any thoughts on that, Emma?
Yeah, so this is the second Richard Haas tweet this week that I have agreed with, and I am so confused because this never happens. But he's right. Yeah. And the other tweet that I really agreed with was on Omicron and how shutting borders isn't a good response to, you know, new strains of COVID. And I think in both cases this is right. The US, we've been doing a slightly better job on the vaccination and the COVID response stuff since Joe Biden came into office, but it's not enough. I mean, what we're seeing is that, you know, the US and then the Western world more generally, you know, we have all these vaccines, we vaccinate our own population, and then we have these, you know, reservoirs overseas in countries that haven't managed to vaccinate enough people, develop new variants that come back and might actually overwhelm the vaccines. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a humanitarian to think that vaccinating the world is the right approach here. I mean, that helps, but, you know, from a purely cold-hearted, self-interested perspective, the sooner we vaccinate everybody, the quicker we might actually be able to get back to some kind of normalcy. And so again, this has to be, I'm very surprised I agree with him, but I have to say he's got it right.
So you are in the ideological flow of, as Van would say, the Undiplomatic Podcast, and perhaps Richard Haas has started, is it Haas or Haas? Richard Haas has started listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast or something to have a change of heart.
I'm not sure he's had a change of heart, but yeah, I doubt there's many tweets from him that get agreed with on this show, but you know, sometimes a stopped clock is right.
Cool. So the second tweet is from Michael Kimmich, who is a professor of history at Catholic University. And his tweet goes, "One thing is clear, whatever comes of the Russian buildup around Ukraine, that Europe is what it has always been, a battlefield of competing ethnic, national and imperial entities, untethered to the dreams of W. Wilson and Bush Sr., and tragically far from whole, free and at peace."
Obviously. Yeah, Michael was definitely having a morning when he put that one out. It's he was really pretty depressed, I think. But I mean, he's right, you know, and this is, you know, we've spent the last 30 years since the collapse of the Cold War, in many ways sort of telling ourselves that, you know, international institutions will resolve all conflicts, that, you know, if we just keep up with European Union expansion, NATO expansion, that it will help to tamp down all these conflicts, you know, that basically destroyed the first half of the 20th century in Europe. And what we've seen repeatedly is that that's not really true. I mean, you know, we had conflicts throughout the 1990s in the Balkans. Those threatened to flare up again all the time. We had a war in Georgia in 2008. We've had the war in Ukraine since 2014. And now we've got Russia massing troops on Ukraine's border. And so, you know, I think while, you know, the institutions that we think about have had some notable successes, right? European integration is a success story in economic terms. We are somewhat kidding ourselves if we think it got rid of all of the problems, the security problems that have plagued that region for a long time. And to some extent, you know, the bill is coming due for the choices that we made in the 1990s, right? So we chose to expand NATO, and it probably helped stabilize the security situation in Eastern Europe at that time. but now it is helping to destabilize the situation as Russia reacts to it. So, you know, I think, again, Michael definitely having a bit of a day there when he put out a tweet that depressing, but he's fundamentally correct about the security dynamics of Europe. It is not about, you know, some grand project of European integration. It's about trying to deal with Europe's borders and where conflict might flare up again.
It strikes me that a lot of these competing ethnic and national identities are playing out within European governments or within European countries themselves, with, you know, French elections, German elections, right? We see this sort of ethnic identity and xenophobia, immigration being politicized in elections increasingly. But at the same time, I can't help worrying that this sort of line also plays into Putin's hand, because I think I'm no Kremlinologist, I'm not a Russia or a European expert, but I think Putin benefits from the sort of line that, look, Europe is a messy intersection of, you know, different races and religions, and, you know, you'll be safe rallying around the flag and sort of protecting the Russian people, for instance, that sort of nationalist calling card benefits the autocrats and the right wing aspiring autocrats in different European states.
Well, it really does. Yeah, I mean, it definitely benefits them. I mean, the Russians have this habit of a policy called passportization, which is where they go out in the countries close to Russia, they find the Russian ethnic minorities, right? Because back when the Soviet Union existed, all the ethnic minorities, everything just got mixed up in a giant blender, right? And so there's large minority Russian populations in most of these states. The Russians go out, give them passports, then claim their citizens and say, well, we have the right to go in militarily and defend them. So, you know, this is a problem, this is a weakness. But I mean, I think what we're seeing in recent years a lot is that some of the, you know, it's easy for autocrats to exploit the inherent flaws of the system that we have. You know, everything from disinformation and election meddling in the US to, you know, as you say, some of these sort of ethnic conflicts, you know, maybe in the Balkans that are kind of submerged, kind of managed, but they could flare up again. And those are the easy places for autocrats to interfere. And, you know, so I would argue that the answer is probably not trying to push the autocrat to stop. It's trying to resolve those problems where we can at home. And, you know, and that might look something like trying to resolve frozen conflicts in Eastern Europe. It might look something like better election systems in the West. And I just feel like that is the more likely route to actually resolve the problem. Whereas the, you know, the sort of pushing Russia until it stops approach is pretty unlikely to succeed.
Well, underscores the promise, perhaps, the potential of the Summit for Democracies, which I guess will be a recurring summit.
Apparently, yes. But again, you know, I think could be a success if the administration focuses it on the things that we can do to defend the West, to defend liberal values, to defend democracy, right? That is something that I think is a wonderful mission and a wonderful goal. But I don't think that's necessarily going to be what we're talking about. I think what we're going to be talking about is China and Russia, and that's not very productive.
And I think to the tweet's point, I think it does a disservice for us to even pretend like this united Europe fallacy that's been produced has even ever been considered. It's more united Western Europe, right? Because people in Europe are still fighting to be considered European. Bosnians, Ukrainians, like we talked about earlier, you know, they're not quite included in this grand project, even though for all intents and purposes they should be. And I think that's, you're right, we need to stop making it like a big summit of democracies, because it's really not. And it just never has been. So we just got to treat it as it really is.
The realist in
you. Or maybe also, or maybe, you know, accept as well that the European Union and its members don't necessarily have a veto on who's European, right? Russians are Europeans, you know, and have typically considered themselves to be so. So, you know, again, I think this is a broader question than just one of like the European Union and where it expands to. Okay, yeah, so I have another Russia tweet. This one is from Gavin Wild, and it says, realists and internationalists keep saying, we need to deal with Russia as it is, not as we'd like it to be, and then nodding at each other while meaning radically different things. And so I think this tweet is hilarious, and every Russia specialist that I know, whether they are a hawk or a dove, a realist or an internationalist, thought this was really funny, because it's totally true. So realists look at Russia and say, we need to deal with Russia as it is, not as we'd like it to be. And what they mean is, we can't force Russia to change. We have to find a way to cooperate with Russia, live with Russia, build a European security architecture that we can all live with. And then what sort of internationalist hawks look at is they say, oh, well, we have to deal with Russia as it is, not as we'd like it to be, which means we have to accept that Vladimir Putin is insatiably expansionist and, you know, nothing we do will ever dissuade him from trying to conquer most of Europe. And so I thought this tweet was really hilarious because it's just two different groups of people with very different worldviews saying the exact same thing and meaning something totally different.
Interesting. When you said internationalist hawks, the way I heard the tweet was more like Wilsonian internationalists, and I was thinking of institutions and the role of NATO or the European Union in providing a European community as a sort of bulwark against Russian expansionism. So not exactly an hawk.
No, it's true. I guess I ascribed hawkish to it there, but I think that was kind of the meaning of the tweet. But you're right. These are people that would typically, internationalists, institutionalists, who would typically argue that, you know, NATO has been a very stabilizing force in Europe, that it helps to protect countries from Russia, and that sort of NATO is not the problem, Russia is the problem, is what they would typically argue. Whereas a lot of realists would say, well, you know, NATO doesn't have to mean to be a problem for Russia to necessarily perceive it as a problem, right? There's a place where we can all misunderstand what one another's doing and be threatened by one another, even if it wasn't intentional. Okay, yeah, and so then I have another one from Matt Duss, who I know gets quoted a lot on here, but does have some really great tweets. And the other day he said, quote, I'm not trying to kink shame anyone, but it's weird how the credibility fetishists seem to think the only way credibility gets damaged is by not getting into wars, unquote. And again, just really funny because there's been all this talk lately about how American credibility has been damaged by withdrawing from Iraq, by refusing to fight in Ukraine, and, you know, that no other American ally will ever trust us again. And I think, you know, Matt is right in the serious point here that actually, you know, the fact that we spent 20 years fighting a failed war in Afghanistan rather than focusing on Asia, you know, that is something that probably should lead various Asian allies to be doubtful about US interests and whether the US is going to back them. So, you know, I think this is kind of funny because he's, you know, referring to credibility fetishists. But it also is a really serious point that I really like, which is that, you know, people in Washington never look at the failures of US foreign policy in the last 20 years and wonder how that might impact their credibility. They're just focused on the wars that we're not fighting.
That's brilliant. On the issue of credibility, I always think of this article by Ian Henry, who's a scholar at the Australian National University. Shout out to ANU here. In the journal International Security from a couple of years ago, he essentially, I hope not to mischaracterize this, but essentially what his argument is that more than credibility, what allies are interested in is reliability, which oftentimes manifests in not doing something stupid or counter to their interests. So it's not purely in demonstrating troop commitments or sort of the defense expenditures that sort of the insular Washington debate might think characterizes a demonstration of credibility, but rather being a good ally might entail just being smart and not misstepping but or overplaying a bad hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Obama made a lot of mistakes, but don't do stupid shit as a grand strategy is actually pretty underrated. And I think you could make a really good argument, I think, about, you know, some of the things that the US has been saying and doing towards Ukraine in the last, in the last decade, saying, you know, even a couple of weeks ago, right, we had the Secretary of Defense saying the US has an ironclad commitment to Ukrainian sovereignty. what does that mean, right? We know we're not going to send troops to defend Ukraine. So that is unreliable, right? We're saying one thing, we're meaning another. It would be much better for our credibility if we were clear about what we were actually committing to or not.
All right, time for Armchair Analysis, where we look at a different article each week. Okay, for this week's Armchair Analysis, we've selected an article in Foreign Affairs by Michael Folilove and Hervé Lemahieu at the Lowy Institute in Foreign Affairs. The title of the article is America is Up and China is Down in Asia. And that rather simple headline comes from a much more nuanced and granular study, which they call the Asia Power Index. It's an annual study they release, which assesses, based on a variety of metrics, countries' overall influence in the world, based on natural resources and a variety of other factors like economic development and charitable donations of COVID vaccines, for instance, around the world, as well as internal political dynamics. A few takeaways in this piece that struck me was, so first of all, the characterization of the United States as a multidimensional power in contrast to China, which has outperformed the United States in Asia, both economically and with rising military power in recent years, and diplomatic attention, for instance, which was lacking generally under the Trump administration and, you know, Biden administration got a slow start with its engagement with Southeast Asian partners and allies as well. This year's Asia Power Index, the authors find that the U.S. now outranks China in future resources, which is a surprise to me in some ways, based on the sort of overall narrative of relative U.S. decline and China's sort of inexorable rise, which again is often oversimplified. But the fact that the index this year finds the U.S. is actually the one who stood or boasts relative gains in the region is a somewhat reassuring surprise. You know, to caveat that, the authors do make clear that the future influence of both great powers depends in part on how these great powers use the resources available to them. So, second point I found interesting, given how many actors they're looking at across Asia and around the world acting in Asia, they still note that a bipolar future beckons. So this stands in contrast to what I think is probably the prevailing view, despite the media's sort of framing things in bipolar terms, that Asia remains a multipolar region. So you think of Japan, Southeast Asians also look to the European Union and a variety of other countries engaged in the region like Australia. But the trend line they identify is that bipolarity is on the rise. Finally, a point they note, which I would echo emphatically, is that if there's one factor that threatens the United States' strong position in Asia, it is the decline in its regional economic influence. So I feel like I've read this line 1,000 times in a variety of various outlets this week, that the U.S. has no economic strategy for the region. And this is so important these days when Asian countries now essentially take the U.S. security presence, not for granted, but as a somewhat benign, you know, their conflicting opinions regarding the U.S. military presence, but that's essentially all it's got now. And it's put forward its military footprint without having a viable economic strategy to back it up. And when you look at U.S. alliances with Japan and Korea, for instance, they have troops in both countries, but at the same time, we have robust trade ties. And that really underpins a much more holistic presence in the region. So the role of economics in this fastest growing economic region in the world is vital. And this year, we have the two largest multilateral trade deals in the world now, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP, as well as the recently concluded RCEP, or Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. RCEP includes China. China has expressed interest in joining the CPTPP, and neither includes the United States. And the United States has hinted at a sort of digital connectivity and regional supply chain resilience sort of initiative, but they have yet to signal any broader economic strategy to appeal to the region. And currently, it appears incredibly unlikely that in the first or in the next few years of the Biden administration, that Washington will genuinely make a move to rejoin CPTPP, from which Trump withdrew in 2017. As a sort of final note, which I think is a point perhaps most fundamental to this Asia Power Index and the finding of U.S. power, the article only in the final few sentences touches on the fact that U.S. political dysfunction and internal disarray could potentially sap its power and influence in the future, which I think is a huge the point is essential to the future of U.S. power. If the assumption is that the U.S. will continue to harbor its resources and play them wisely, well, I think we're being a bit naive and overlooking the potential sort of dark horse here, which is the disarray and political dysfunction. Partisan divides within the country get worse, not better. So I'm a bit surprised they sort of loaded that at the bottom of the article. But I think it arguably could play a much larger role in the debate going forward.
Yeah, it's funny that you say about the internal dysfunction thing, because the last thought I had on reading this article was, oh, well, okay, you know, China has loads of problems, we have loads of problems, maybe it'll even out somehow. I thought this article was interesting. I definitely had a few concerns about, you know, I mean, I'm not 100% sure about the methodology. Like, I think I'd have to go and find the paper and actually look it up. But, you know, one of my colleagues, Matt Burrows, and a team of people at the Pardee School at the University of Denver, they did a similar study earlier this year on American and Chinese like soft power and influence around the world, not just in Asia. And they came up with basically the opposite finding, which is that China is sort of rising in influence and the US is basically stagnant. So I'm a little unsure about why that is. It seems to me like this Lowy Institute one really prioritizes military hardware and military presence and alliances, and that might be why, and particularly that might be why they're saying there's been such an improvement into the Biden administration, even though there's not really been many concrete changes. So I was a little skeptical about that, to be honest. You know, and I flagged, it's funny, I flagged the same comment as you, that a bipolar future beckons. I have thoughts on that. I mean, even not being an Asia specialist, I'm not really sure how you get there in a region that includes India, that includes Japan, that includes South Korea. But I thought the most interesting part of the article was the economic part. You know, they make the point, I think, that the US has all this military power, perhaps cultural soft power, good ties in the region, but we are just completely blowing it on economics. You know, they talk about the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific economic engagement strategy, which I understand is coming soon, but thus far nobody seems to know what it is. It appears to be some collection of like, we'll do digital trade deals, you know, and then we'll talk about, you know, worker-centered trade focus, something like that. It's there's really just no details at all. And as you say, like, you know, on the other side, we've got the CPTPP, which is the remnants of the TPP that the US actually helped negotiate. We've got the RCEP, RCEP, I think. I'm not sure how people are pronouncing that, but you know, but we have those. Yeah, RCEP. Okay, so we've got those deals in which China is like trying to get involved if it isn't already involved, and the US is just sort of nowhere to be seen. So that was, you know, that was my big takeaway from this article, was I don't think what the authors intended it to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I haven't pored over this year's report too closely. I think it's next week. They're doing an event roll or report rollout event here and online. But it seems that they give Biden a lot of points for shoring up alliances that were a bit shaky after the Trump years. And not to say that Trump only damaged American alliances. You know, in Asia, actually, he got along quite well with some partners and allies, such as Japan and the Philippines, and even Thailand, which are problematic for Western liberal values, at least with regard to the latter two in Southeast Asia. But yeah, my broader point is I think they try to capture a more holistic measure of power and influence that does get beyond military. But this article certainly highlights some of the military developments like AUKUS to show this is favorable for the US balance of power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the point. And, you know, I know from listening to this podcast that some people in here probably have slightly different views than me on trade. I'm much more of a classical liberal. I think trade is a good thing, a really good thing. But, you know, I do think that in Asia, you know, China has a finger in every pot on trade. And if the US wants to compete, wants to play in that game, then we need to be there on trade. We need to be there on economics, because it's not just about military strength. And, you know, I think the Obama administration got that right back in, you know, the early 2010s. And this article points out sort of that the political consensus in the US has moved so far away from free trade that it's going to be hard to actually, like, politically accomplish that and find any kind of coherent strategy. And so I'm not very optimistic that the US is actually going to be able to find something that works there.
Yeah, which is, I think, why so far they've emphasized this sort of digital connectivity angle and prioritizing things like regional supply chain resilience, microprocessor production, you know, shifting away from reliance on China, for instance, which benefits the United States and some of its partners, potentially, in a big way, as well as things like intellectual property. But then again, some of the strongest intellectual property protections were fundamental to the TPP agreement, which the United States spent so long negotiating and then walked away from. So the best way to achieve a lot of these goals would be to rejoin the CPTPP. Personally, being outside of Washington now for a few years, I'm still somewhat perplexed when I see polling by the Chicago Council, for instance, that says generally Americans now support free trade, realize its importance, and are not anti-trade in general. Why is this still billed as such a toxic, why are free trade agreements still toxic on the Hill? I really cannot wrap my head around this disconnect. And I've tried talking to others in the sort of blob in DC about this, and they all sort of say the same thing, that it'll, you know, CPTPP will never happen under the Biden administration. And it just seems like it's not likely to be feasible under Republican or Democratic administration in Washington in the next few years.
Probably the classic political economy answer, which is, you know, concentrated costs, diffuse benefits. People like free trade because it makes goods cheaper, but the costs do fall disproportionately on a smaller group of people who often can lobby for it. I mean, I will say one of the interesting shifts, just the huge shifts that happened in foreign policy in the last 5 years, is the Republican Party adopted Trump's anti-trade line. They went from being basically free traders to being much, much more protectionist and worker focused. And this is just really interesting. You know, I attended an event recently where one of the questions from the audience was, you know, how do you fit, you know, I hear you talking about free trade and foreign policy. How do you account for the conservative hostility to open and free trade that hurts workers? I mean, you could have just knocked me over with a feather. That question would not have been asked 5 years ago. Or if it had been asked, it would have been, how do you account for the, you know, the progressive or the liberal pushback against free trade? It's, the shift has been so dramatic in recent years that I think that's part of the problem. I mean, imagine a Biden administration in a universe where that didn't happen. They're going to rely on Republican votes to get free trade agreements passed. They can't do that anymore. That completely changes the balance of politics in Washington.
Well said. Well, I think personally, I could say that's the most original and insightful take on this debate I've heard recently.
So for Ask Me Anything this week, I have three questions for you, Emma. The first one is from Anonymous. I know there's more than one kind of restrainer point of view, but I was wondering if you could explain what a good restraint position looks like on Putin, Russia.
So I think we covered some of this already, actually, in the Russia comments. But yeah, so this person's right. There are many flavors of restraint. I tend to be associated with the restraint school. I'm actually a realist. But I think, you know, as it comes to Ukraine, a general understanding of the fact that some of our policies in Eastern Europe have been counterproductive in recent years, a general understanding that we need to find some kind of new equilibrium with Russia, because it's problematic. And then restrainers differ pretty substantially on how they feel about, you know, alliances, for example. I tend to be, you know, I think the US should support NATO allies as they are inside the alliance right now, but not extend those benefits to other states because that weakens the alliance. But, you know, I guess just to give my own take on this, you know, I think that what we need to be doing here is trying to find an off-ramp that prevents a major conflict that decimates and destroys Ukraine. There has to be some kind of equilibrium that is acceptable to Western powers, to Ukraine, to Russia, that would allow Ukraine to integrate economically with the West, perhaps, that would allow them to reap some of the benefits of moving westward while not angering Russia, not pushing Russia to take the steps that it's threatening to take, because it would be worse for everybody involved if we ended up with an actual war. And so, you know, that's going to be a really difficult needle to thread. You know, it's going to require some combination of, you know, deterrence. That is to say, bolstering defences in Eastern European NATO members, and cooperation, trying to do diplomacy with Russia on this. But I really think it's the only way you get out of this situation that doesn't end up in a major war, which would be worse for everybody.
While we're here, so this, I think, is just breaking news. Perhaps you've already seen it immediately before the podcast started. We're recording on Friday, December 10th. But it seems like there's a bit of news about potentially the Biden administration convincing or trying to urge Ukrainians to cede some autonomy in the east of Ukraine. Is that reckless in your opinion, or am I sort of, there's a leading question if you've ever heard one.
Yeah, that's a leading question. It's not only not reckless, it's existing policy. That's not a policy change. The way that it's being framed in the media is that this is some sort of concession. That is actually the terms of the Minsk II agreement from like years ago, is that the Ukrainians would cede some autonomy to the eastern regions, you know, give them rights to like use the Russian language in public and in schools, that kind of thing, give them some political autonomy in exchange for basically Russia's not named, but in exchange for Russia giving them back control of the border and ending the conflict. And that was the Minsk II agreement, and it never got put into place because Kiev couldn't figure out how to bring together a political coalition to pass that autonomy law. The Russians refused to give back border control as a result. And, you know, we've just been stuck in a stalemate since. So I don't think this is reckless. I think this is just trying to push the Ukrainians to implement the part of the deal that they didn't implement, and then hopefully we'll put pressure on Russia to implement the parts of the deal that it didn't implement a few years back.
So I'll move on to our second question, who's also anonymous. Do you ever see Democrat or Republican foreign policy experts dating or marrying? James Carville married a Republican, but that was a long time ago. What are your general thoughts about walking the personal political line in Washington?
That's a really interesting question. I will say I was lucky enough to be, I was already married when I came to DC. So like I have never had to deal with the dating scene, which I understand is horrifyingly bad. But I will say, you know, on foreign policy, it's not so much the like Democrat Republican line you have to worry about. It's the, I mean, hawk dove line, for lack of a better explanation. So foreign policy doesn't really run down party lines, right? I used to work at the Cato Institute, and we would work pretty closely, you know, with people on the Hill. You know, the senators that we aligned with most closely were like Rand Paul and Mike Lee, Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy. Rokana, right? It makes no sense. It's progressives and libertarians, it's conservative Republicans. So the fault lines are really different on foreign policy. And so, you know, to the extent that it's an issue in foreign policy, I suspect it's crossing a different divide rather than the sort of Republican-Democrat divide. But you might want to ask somebody who's actually been in the dating scene in the last 10 years, because I have not.
Well, thank you anyway for trying to answer that. I'll move on to our third question, which is from a writer at the Asia Times. What do you think about the nuclear umbrella? Extended nuclear deterrence, useful, dangerous, outdated, or other?
Yeah, so here I'm really probably getting out over my skis because I'm not a nuclear specialist. But, you know, I tend to share the concern of a lot of realists about extended deterrence, which is that it's not particularly credible. You know, this was an issue during the Cold War, you know, when there were debates about, are we going to trade Chicago for Berlin, right? And at the end of the day, it never came to that. And so we don't actually have any evidence as to whether extended deterrence works or not. And I think today we're starting to see those same concerns, right? In Europe, we see the expansion of NATO, you know, we're expanding our nuclear umbrella out to places that we never would have dreamed of. And the same in Asia, where the nuclear umbrella hasn't really expanded so much. But now that China is building up its nuclear capabilities, the question is arising more. And so I am concerned about extended deterrence because I'm not entirely sure it's credible. And I'm not entirely sure what we would do in a crisis situation. And so to that extent, I think extending our nuclear umbrella can sometimes be pretty destabilizing. Whether it would be more destabilizing than countries like South Korea getting their own nuclear arsenal, again, I think that's a question I'm not really qualified to answer. But I really appreciate the question because I think it's something we don't talk about a lot. We talk about US nuclear weapons, you know, our arsenal, our nuclear modernization, about, you know, as if it's about defending the US. But in actual fact, you know, the US extends these guarantees to lots of different countries with our nuclear umbrella. And we really don't know if it's safe to do that or not, or if it actually puts US security in more danger. So that's, I find it quite worrying, to be honest. But again, I'm not sure that I know enough to actually make a call.
Where's your former colleague, Eric Gomez, when we need him?
Yeah. So, a plug for Eric. Eric Gomez over at Cato has written widely on this. I would recommend going looking up his work, and he definitely knows what he's talking about, which I do not.
Hunter, a question for you, Hunter, as well. But the asker is also happy to have anyone talk about it. So what is it like doing a PhD in Australia, especially coming from the DC think tank world? How is it different from the US? And I guess, Emma, you could probably give an opinion on moving into the US and into DC and the world outside of that.
Great question, and one I'm always happy to discuss. I chose the Australian National University personally because of my interest in Southeast Asia. I knew the ANU for their really deep bench of Asia experts for many years and wrote for a few of their outlets prior to coming here. But beyond that, since I arrived, I realized that the department I'm in, International Relations, is also quite well regarded around the world. And I think the number one concern is, you know, that potential PhD students want to take into account is, what do you want to do with the degree? If you want to teach in the US, you probably want to do your PhD in the US as well. Personally, I don't have much interest in teaching anytime soon. So I wanted to go work with the experts who I was most interested in studying under and working alongside. And the ANU turned out to be the perfect community for that. I also didn't want to retake the GREs, to be candid. And I was told that if I went back to, just to rewind a bit, the overseas, the sort of European option is a shorter PhD, potentially 3 or 4 years, although I don't know anybody who does the PhD in 3 here. So it's looking more like 4.5 for me. And then I was told basically to expect 6 or 7 years at a US PhD program, which is just so long. And on top of retaking the GREs, not an attractive option. I also understood that if I went back to the University of Washington, where I did my master's degree, that I might not have to repeat master's coursework, just do a four-year PhD, which is nice. But then again, I kind of wanted to get some variety in my own studies and where I was learning, who I was learning from. I had a great experience at the University of Washington in my master's program, but didn't necessarily want to repeat. And then I didn't want to do a PhD in Washington. I know that there are a number of really terrific programs that I would absolutely recommend considering. But personally, I see myself coming back to Washington when I'm done with the PhD. So really, this is just a wonderful excursion, COVID aside, and being sort of disrupted with international travel for several years. But the Australian National University is a great option for anyone exploring sort of the Asia IR nexus for a PhD. Asian security issues and international relations here are top-notch. But then again, there are excellent programs in the UK. I would have looked more carefully at Singapore. RSIS was an appealing option, but I was told they no longer give scholarships to international students. ANU still does, so that's also something. And another piece of advice that a mentor at Brookings, where I used to work, gave to me, Tanvi Madan, I'll thank her here. She said, don't go anywhere where you're not given a scholarship, because it's sort of a two-way street, and it's a signal that they're interested, the program is interested in you just as much as you're interested in them. And I've found that that absolutely holds true in my experience at ANU. It's been a good match. I have a great community and support network here from the university.
Yeah, so that, I don't have a lot to add to that, honestly. I personally did all my schooling in America, even though I'm British, so I don't actually have personal experience with the British PhD. I will say, for people interested in policy who are, who want to go off and get the PhD, I typically try to discourage them from doing that. Because an American PhD takes, as you say, 5 to 7 years. And during that process, you're sort of socialized into doing academic work, not policy work, pushed towards doing the academic job market. And then you get out and the job market is utterly awful. It's just horrifyingly bad in the US. I typically try to encourage people who are interested in policy to steer away from the PhD, or at least to do as you have done, consider an Australian PhD, an Asian PhD, a British PhD, a French PhD, that takes 3 years, that's just 3 or 4 years, that's just a research program, doesn't come with quite all the benefits of doing US program, but at least you get done faster, you get less debt, and you still get the credential out of it. I'm still fairly skeptical, even though I have the PhD myself, I'm still fairly skeptical of the value of going into one at this point with the way academia and the job market's looking. But I think foreign PhDs are probably a slightly better option if that's the way people are interested.
Now that I'm looking back at the actual question, I realize I didn't really answer. I'm used to answering this as why did I choose ANU in Australia, coming from America and from DC in particular. But the question asks, what's it like doing a PhD here, especially coming from the DC think tank world? And one aspect I imagine is a bit different here is that in Australia, you're taught, and especially in the Coral Bell School where I study, you're taught a bit more of the English school, which I don't think is as much emphasized in US programs. And it's a really interesting synthesis of realism and constructivism that I was not familiar with in my master's work, which wasn't necessarily in international relations, was in area studies, but I still read, the classical realists and, like the Waltzes and Mearsheimers and neorealists, as well as some more recent constructivist stuff. So the English school was new to me, and that's been pretty eye-opening. So I had a diversity of opinions, or schools of thought here, perhaps is a bit different.
Yeah, so I guess, just while we were recording, we learned that Bob Jervis, professor of international affairs, one of the sort of grandfathers of the field of international relations, has passed away. I'm very surprised. He was still active and working, and everybody, very engaged with the community still. His seminal book, Perception and Misperception in International Politics, is You know, not just one of the classics in the field. It really is a must read if you want to think about not just international relations in the academic sense, but if you want to think about how policymakers approach foreign policy decision-making, and sort of how to approach the world. I mean, it certainly was instrumental in my own thinking and how I came to some of my opinions on foreign policy, even though I didn't necessarily agree with Jervis on everything. So that's just some really sad news, and a real loss for the field.
Yeah, I'm using Jervis's classic work in my dissertation and literature review. So Emma, I have to apologize for the fact that you found out this way. I realized that wasn't the best way to come across the news, which I think Jake shared with us in a private chat just now. So I had a moment to digest that before blurting it out really impolitically to you.
No worries. I mean, I didn't know him, but I know many people who did. He was a great mentor to students at Columbia. I believe he mentored my own advisor, my dissertation advisor, when he was at Columbia. So again, generations of students that he's mentored when he was there.
Yeah, I'm sure Van will have more to say on this in the next episode. And I heard that he tweeted something because I know that Van followed his lead closely, and I, no doubt Robert Jervis impacted a great many PhD scholars in the last half century. Well, on that somber note, perhaps we can.
I think maybe it doesn't feel like best to do that. Try after the somber note. Yeah,
maybe just.
I think that's probably a good place to leave it.
Yeah, no, so that was a bit of a downer at the end, but
I'm really sorry.
Yeah, good to, I mean, I didn't really know him. As I say, I know plenty of people who did know him very well, but I didn't really know him well, so, but yeah, that's a real loss. He was still so just engaged, you know? But yeah, thank you so much. I should let you guys get on with your day. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you really so much for sharing your insights. Yeah.